You know, I'm doing another Ironman in 4 weeks, and if I don't finish, it's because of you guys. I'm supposed to be doing about an 8-hour bike ride this weekend, and I've just been drinking and listening to speakers. So, but I'm really happy to be here. I love this organization. I love all the speakers. Ron Reagan last night. Phil speaking was amazing. I was thinking late last night. I was thinking about all the speakers and how lucky I was to be an atheist. This is after the fourth round of oral sex I had. I only had two when I was a Christian, so that was a lot better. Anyway, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my journey. And when I was 25 or so, my life was a complete mess. I had married my crazy high school sweetheart. Don't do that. I had left this crazy high school sweetheart, but I never divorced her because she was so effing crazy. And so I was dating, I was having a great time, and I got a girl pregnant while I was still married. And my career was just really stalled out. So I was incredibly depressed, and I thought my life was over. And I did what most males do, is I didn't tell a soul. Anybody ask me, how's your life? It's unbelievable, outstanding, couldn't be better. And so then my best friend pulled me aside and he said, you know, what is wrong with you? You got something really wrong in your life. And so I spilled my guts out to him. He said, you know what's missing from your life, Bill, is God. And at the time, he could have said crack cocaine. And I would have taken it because I was in tremendous pain. And he had a solution out of this pain. So he said, I'll pick you up and I'll take you to church Sunday. So I said, fantastic. And I was raised a minor league Catholic. I was Episcopalian. And we would go to church each week. And I was a crucifer and did all the stuff. And even then, I would think as they were talking about the Trinity, you know, three in one. I was a kid, but I was like, how could there be three things, but they're really one God? And this is in downtown Long Beach, California. And it was a ghetto, but the whole congregation was white. And so I kept thinking, you know, the Jesus' words and help the poor, and we have to step over the homeless to get inside. And it just didn't make a lot of sense to me, but I went along with the program. And then after church, we'd have this great, you know, occasionally it'd get to me, I'd feel sort of holy. But it wouldn't take before we're out of the parking lot for my dad to start screaming at us about something. And I thought, you know, he's not quite getting this thing. So I didn't really understand this religion thing. So as soon as I could stop going, which is about 17, I stopped. And so I went to this, so my friend took me to this church. It's a mega church in Irvine, California. And, you know, the Episcopal church, they had those silver kettles of coffee and they had a couple of stale donuts. But here they had like a latte machine and they had, croissants. And instead of an organ, they had this really great band. And everybody looked. One of my problems tonight was I didn't know what to wear because atheists, and I'm not you guys, but atheists are the not the most fashion-forward people. And so I didn't know whether to wear my, 30,000 kids died today of hunger, what makes you think God's going to answer your prayers, T-shirt, or my members-only jacket, my Birkenstocks. Where's the woman that won the $50 bill up there? Stand up. This is how you should look. Look at that. You guys look nothing like her. Don't flatter yourself. So, where was I? Okay. So I went to this church, and everybody looked like her. It was just like this. Everybody's attractive, and I'm not a big hugger, but they're hugging each other. They seem so happy. And the pastor gave this, they call it a message, not a sermon, a message, and it was, he tied in the Bible with everyday life, and it just made sense to me. It's like, okay, I have my father was, is this on tape? I did not have the perfect father. And so all of a sudden, I have a perfect father that can love me no matter what. He can't love me any more, any less from what I do. He's going to take care of me. I just have to pray. And I have all these new friends around me. And I didn't have to really take, I don't have to take control of my life. I had to give up control. It was a wonderful thing. And I thought, okay, I'm all in. And so I went into Bible study. I did all this. I did everything they said to do. And my life started to change around. I had better friends. I made better choices. And I had a friend of mine. Some of you probably have never been on a religious retreat, but if you get the opportunity, do not go. It's a hideous experience, and you go with, if you're a guy, you go with all guys. You're in this Spartan cabin. There's no cell phones. There's no nothing there. Nothing to drink, and there's not enough to drink here, by the way. I went to the ex-Mormon conference a couple months ago. They drank like fishes here. Yeah. So anyway. So you go to this, and the whole idea of the weekend is to wear you down, to wear down your emotions, to wear down your walls you have. And so I'll read first, and I'm embarrassed to read this in front of you guys, but Dan used to be a pastor, so that helps me out. And then the other Dan, I mean, he went to freaking Brazil to try to convert, so I don't feel so bad, but this is what happened to me. This is on Sunday. It says after you're worn down, you're very tired. After the music, Mike Barris, a pastor-to-be who conducted the climactic Sunday morning service, asked the men gathered in the chapel a simple question that he should have anticipated but hadn't. Have you publicly pronounced Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior? I hadn't. I wasn't ready to. Panicked, my pulse quickened, my eyes darted. I suddenly felt trapped. I didn't want to be a born-again Christian. I knew what I thought of them. I knew what people less tolerant, that'd be you guys, than I thought of them. I couldn't even say Jesus in public. The weekend had been such a great spiritual experience. Why did Barris have to wreck it by forcing this born-again question on me? My walls quickly came back up. I needed more time to warm up to the idea of being called born again. Barris went on to say that a public profession of faith was an important part of the Christian journey. He asked us to bow our heads, close our eyes, and pray. In a gentle voice, he told those who felt moved to accept Christ into their hearts today to raise their hand. My heart beat even faster, but no longer in self-defense. I couldn't believe it, but I felt the urge to lift my hand. But I sure as heck... That's not funny. This is a pivotal moment in my life. But I sure as heck didn't want to be the only one. So I took a peek around the room and saw several hands shoot up. What was I going to do? My eternal fate might rest on this decision. Maybe not, said another voice inside my head. This whole born-again thing could be just a bunch of crap. I should have listened to that voice. I shut my eyes and prayed. That seemed the safe and non-committal. But there was an urge again to raise my hand. Was it from God? My heart threatened to beat out of my chest. I was at the edge of a cliff, weighing whether to jump. I wanted to take the plunge, but I didn't want to be looked upon as a freak. I didn't know how to explain my conversion to my atheist friends. I didn't want to imagine how I'd change once Jesus truly became the centerpiece of my life. Would I be wearing a rainbow wig and a handlebar mustache inside a football stadium, waving a John 3:16 sign at the television camera? Would I be compelled to walk away from the material pleasures and devote my life to helping the poor? I didn't want to find out. Barris was very good at his job, not in any rush. He said he still felt there were others in the chapel who wanted to become Christians today. He'd wait a few minutes in case anybody else wanted to raise his hand. Was he talking to me, I wondered, or was it God speaking? My pulse actually slowed as at last I obeyed. My hand seemed to float up on its own until it was over my head. Barris asked those who'd raise our hands to repeat the sinner's prayer, then I list it. When I repeated the line, I invite Jesus into my heart, I experienced what only I can call a vision. Time slowed. In my mind's eye, my heart opened into halves, and a warm, glowing light flowed right in. As my heart melted back together, it remained illuminated with a soft light from the inside. I felt instantly the light was Jesus, who now lived inside of me. A tingling warmth spread across my chest. This, I thought, no, I knew, was what it was meant to be born again. So I had this magical, mystical experience, and I was even further in. I mean, I didn't think I could be, but I was even further in. And I was in prayer groups. I was in, you know, study groups. I was doing everything. And I was a journalist, and I saw how the mainstream media covered, especially on the West Coast and the East Coast, how they covered religion and how... in the stories I saw within my faith group, and they were missing these incredibly dramatic stories. Just from an objective point of view, they were interesting stories that the mainstream media did not cover. The mainstream media treated religion, for the most part, like a freak show. It was, you know, it's the Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwells and all those other a-holes, and And it was abortion and homosexuality, basically. And I saw these great stories. So as a journalist, I thought, maybe my calling, or I thought it was from God, maybe my calling is to be a religion writer for the LA Times. I lived in Southern California. I didn't want to move from Southern California, so that was my only option. And I thought, you know, God can do anything, so I'll pray that I become the religion writer for the Times. So for 4 or 5 years, I prayed. And I prayed and prayed, morning, noon, and night. And after about 5 years, I thought, maybe I should actually do something about it and not pray. So I decided to call up the editor of the Times. And I said, I want to meet with you. So she said, okay. So we met. And I said, you know, you what if I told you there were 20,000 people coming to a venue each weekend in Southern California, and you've never written a word about it? And editors are very arrogant people, as you may know. She said, that's impossible. There's no way that could happen. I said, well, at the time, it was 1998. It was, I said, it's Saddleback Church, and there's 20,000 people come there, and you've never reported on it. And so she was struck by this. She said, what else are we missing? So I gave her a list of 20 ideas, and she said, you can write a weekly column for us. And so I thought, God answered my prayers. So I did this weekly column. It was quite miraculous. And I did so well that they said, you know, we can't believe we're missing all these stories. And they were good, just objective journalism stories. They were really good stories. And she said, how about if you, after about a year plus, she said, why don't you write full time for us? And I thought, oh my God, this is like the biggest miracle in the world. You know, God is great. And so the honeymoon continued for a little bit. And then in 2001, right before the Catholic sex scandal came out, I did a story on a kid in Orange County who had been molested by this priest, and he had gotten a settlement for $5.2 million. When he tried to commit suicide, his parents found out. He finally told his parents what happened. His parents, he didn't think his parents would ever believe him, because the priest was nicknamed Father Hollywood. He was the most charismatic priest in Southern California. He drove for a while, a Corvette with a license plate abbreviated Father Hollywood, until the bishop found out, and then he had to give the car back. But he had this dark secret. He was a serial molester. And no one would, and the diocese knew, of course, but no one else knew. And so anybody who came forward, they would vilify. The person that came forward before this kid filed a lawsuit, and the Catholic attorneys had him in deposition for 11 days, if you can imagine. So a victim of being raped, sodomized by a priest, had to answer questions like, did you like it? You know, why did you get an erection? Weren't you really in love with him? That type of thing. So it sort of discouraged other people from coming forward. So anyway, so this guy got a settlement for $5.2 million. I'm at the press conference, and I'm thinking journalists have very dark minds, so I'm thinking in my dark little mind, dark little heart, $5.2 million is just way too much money for what happened to this kid. It happened 20 years ago. He should have gotten over it. Why did he spend all this time? He spent 5 years doing this lawsuit. And so I was talking to a victim's advocate, asking her questions very objectively, I thought. And she said, you know, why don't you come to a victim's meeting? There's one tomorrow night. I said, sure. So I went to the victim's meeting, and there was, if you've never met a victim of clergy sexual abuse, I wouldn't suggest it. It will be a life-changing experience for you. There was about six people, ages 20 to maybe 75. The one that made the most impression on me was a woman who was in her 30s. Her mom was sitting beside her, and what happened was they were immigrants, Mexican immigrants, and the priest took an interest in this daughter when she was 14. The mom was very honored because the dad had left, and she was going to get religious training every Tuesday night. And after the first night, the kid didn't want to go again. The mom says, don't be stupid. This is the greatest man in our community, and you're getting this great religious training. So what he'd do was take her to a hotel room where he and up to seven other priests would rape her. And when she, after a while, she got pregnant. And so the priest told her mom that her daughter had been a very bad girl and been sinful, and that to avoid scandal, they need to ship her to the Philippines until she has the baby. And so the mother did that, and the girl almost died in childbirth in the Philippines. So I'm watching this woman who this happened to, but I'm really watching the mom. And the mom, week after week, for years, put her daughter unintentionally in the path of these monsters. And to see her pain, there's nothing I can describe. I can't describe the pain. It's with me all the time. So this is the second reading here. On the road to Damascus, a light from heaven blinded Saul of Tarsus, who had been attacking Jews who believed Jesus Christ was the Messiah. He fell to the ground and heard God's voice ask, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" 3 days later, a disciple restored Saul's sight and baptized him. From that moment, Saul, with a new name, Paul, dedicated his life to spreading the gospel of Jesus Christ, becoming one of history's most influential figures. I didn't have a sudden conversion, or rather deconversion, after meeting with the sexual abuse of victims. But looking back, it now seems to me as a road to Damascus moment that I kept safely locked away in my subconscious. I drove home in a trance. I'd written so much about the redemptive power of faith, but I had never seen in a real and personal way the opposite, the damage religion could do in the hands of bad people. I looked back on what I had seen on the faith beat and started to wonder, for the first time, about the low level of holiness I was seeing. It was the reason why stories were so easy to spot. People of deep faith, real faith, shine brightly against the dullness of the spiritual pack. This short supply of holiness was something that began to stick in my throat, a disconcerting fact that I washed down with prayer and Christian aphorisms such as, "Don't mix up man's shortcomings with God." It'd take a lot of processing and several years for my conscious thinking to catch up with my gut. When I got home, I tried to tell my wife what I'd seen at the survivors' meeting, but it was impossible to properly put into words. The closest I could come was to say that these people had had their soul shattered and they'd never be whole again. I'd later run across a better description given by Father Thomas Doyle, whose career was stunted by church leaders after he became in 1985 a leading advocate of victims of clergy sexual abuse. He said molesting priests and their superiors were committing soul murder. So, in my great wisdom, I thought this megachurch, in my personal life, this megachurch was very shallow in its theology, and you know, I'm a great intellect, so I needed something deeper, and I thought, you know, as long as you're going for it, why don't you go for the one true church, the Catholic Church? And megachurch, you walk in there, bingo, you're a member. But Catholic Church takes a year. They're very picky. So I started a year-long conversion classes on Tuesday nights and on the weekend. And so starting in 2002, by day, I'd talk to literally hundreds of victims of clergy sexual abuse. I'd be lied to straight out by cardinals, bishops, archbishops, and their lawyers. And then at night, I would learn about the one, you know, the glory and the wonder of the Catholic Church. And in my mind, and this is where you're lifelong atheist, you got to have some empathy, or I don't know if it's empathy, but understand this, is that they were two parallel tracks that would never meet in my mind. It was like the Catholic Church was corrupt in this area, but it didn't take away from its holiness and its greatness over the 2,000-year history. And so you go into the Catholic Church on Easter Vigil, which is Easter Eve. And so this is a big deal. It's like getting married almost, except for you only do it once. And so a week before, I got a tip that there was a priest that was going to get booted from the from his parish because he had a molestation in his past. And of course, until then, it was like in the case of John Gagan in Boston, it was 113 strikes before he was out. But now it was one strike and you're out. So I'm sitting in the back of the church. I'm a father of four. Church is bigger than this place. There was, you know, maybe 1,000 people there. And sitting in the back, and he gets up there and he gives what's typical of priests who molest people. He gives a victim speech. He says, 19 years ago, I had a single boundary violation with a minor. Okay, boundary violation was sodomy. Single boundary violation with a minor, and because of that single incident, I need to step down because of the new zero tolerance policy. So I'm sitting in the back as a father and thinking, this is outrageous. They had this guy, they knew about this guy and let him be a pastor, and I'm very curious what the congregation's reaction is going to be. And so he comes down off the pulpit, and they stand up and they give him a standing ovation like it's the seventh game of the World Series. And there are men and women pouring down tears for this guy. Poor Father Mike. And it gets worse because afterwards, there was a healing session in the parish hall. And I understand this is, you know, this is their pastor for 8 years. There's, you know, it's going to be a shock. But in the parish hall, the first or the second or third thing people say is, we got to find a way to honor Father Mike. He's done so much for us. And so someone goes, well, why don't we, he just helped us build this parish hall. Let's name the parish hall after him. So in my mind, I'm thinking like father slash child molester, Father Mike, you know, whatever. And someone, they second it. They're about to vote on naming this parish hall after this guy. And I'm looking, and there's one guy at the corner of the room, and his veins are about to pop out of his neck. He's like about ready to blow. And so as a reporter, this is a great moment. And I'm thinking, I hope this guy blows, you know. And so so eventually right before they vote, he just yells at the top of his lungs, enough, just enough. And everybody's silent. And I'm thinking, God, this is so bitching. And and he said, you know what, I'm a sheriff's deputy. I deal exclusively with child abuse. And I guarantee you there's not one victim. I've left my kids with this guy. How dare the diocese leave this guy in office, in his post. And you guys call yourselves Christians, and not one of you has ever said anything about the victim. Shame on you, shame on all of you. And he leaves. This is beside the point, but it's kind of funny. So I'm sitting there, and so I want to go talk to him. So I'm kind of sneaking around. So I start to go after him to see if he'll be quoted for the newspaper. And some woman at the very front says, there's even a bigger scandal here. So I sit down, of course, because this is even better. And she goes, I want to know. And she stands up. She goes, what's an LA Times reporter doing in our midst? And she points right to me. So I thought I was going to be martyred right there at the parish. And they turned all their anger right on me, and they're like, you know what? If you report this, you're going to ruin Father Mike's life. Yeah, right. And I said, well, you know, when he molested the kid, that pretty much did it. And then they said, you know, it's only one time. And I said, I've done the story for a long time, and I can guarantee you that it's not one time. And one thing victims hate is when they are discounted. And I said, if there's other victims, they're going to call me up tomorrow and tell me. And the fact is, many, 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 many victims called me the next day. And so when I was driving home that Sunday, I thought, maybe this isn't the best church to go into. And so I didn't go into church. I had to call my little sponsor, and I said, I can't go in the church at this moment. But I thought I'd be back. And over 6 months or a year, I stopped going to church. But in my mind, it wasn't because I stopped believing or anything. It's just because I needed a break, or because I worked on Religion Beat for 40 or 50 or 60 hours a week, and I needed a break from that. And then because I was really good, I had a knack for investigative reporting and cover things. Thankfully, in religion, there's no shortage of scandal and hypocrisy. And so my career was soaring. It was, you know, any scandal that came up, people would tip me off to it. And so my career is going very well. But I realized that these religious institutions were no better than AIG or Enron or Merrill Lynch. And in fact, in a lot of ways, they're worse, because they can say, you know, God's telling me to do this. And it was very disconcerting to me. I was trying to figure out, well, it's, God, man is very sinful, because, you know, these whole religious institutions are incredibly sinful. I covered the televangelists and Benny Hinn and those guys. And in a way, I pray there's a hell, because I would like those guys to be there. They take people that are the most desperate. If you ever want an interesting day, go to a Benny Hinn healing crusade. And he's got the psychology down, but he has people that are so desperate for a cure, whether they are quadriplegics or in the final stages of a terminal disease, that, you know, he says, all you need is enough faith and you will be cured. And enough faith means as much money as you can possibly give him. And he says that. And so they give him all their money, and he gets done with his four-hour crusade. And if you're there, if you're human, you start to think, maybe it's true. At least I did. If you're stupid and human, maybe it's true. And but when Benny walks off the stage with his money, he makes about $100 million a year, lives in a $23 million mansion in Southern California on the cliffs overlooking Dana Point. And he has a very cool move, by the way. When he goes out of town, he's married, he tells his wife that that God said that they can't stay in the same, not the same room, but the same hotel. So he stays in a hotel with his assistant, and she has to stay down the road at a different hotel. Kind of like Joseph Smith. But anyway, where is it? Benny Hinn. But when Benny Hinn walks off stage with all his money, he's left on the floor there as all these people that really believe they were going to be walk out of there cured. And the tragedy is they don't blame Benny Hinn, and they don't blame God. They blame themselves for not having enough faith. And so they're shattered people. So at any rate, I started to think that there's something wrong with me because I knew that my faith was wavering, but I didn't think it was because it wasn't true. I thought it was because, you know, Satan might have got a hold of me or I'm not trying hard enough. So I tried everything I could do to regain my faith because I like my faith. I like the idea of knowing that I was going to go to heaven. I like the idea that there was this loving God looking after me. I like the whole thing. And I based my whole life on it. And so I decided that I was going to, like Lee Strobel, you guys know Lee Strobel. He's this journalist who decided that he's going to see if Christianity were true, and he found it was, his case for Christ. I thought, well, I'm a journalist. I'm an investigative journalist. I'll figure out if my faith was true. And I just wanted 1 ounce of evidence that was true. So I decided to check out the behavior of Christians versus atheists. And I would see which one, you know, as Christians, we were made new in Christ. We're guided by the Holy Spirit. We should, on the whole, have some sort of better behavior than godless atheists. And so I said to myself very naively, you know, I'll spend years on this till I get it right. And it took me about 5 minutes on the internet. And you know, as Phil said last night, I mean, there's not only no difference in many areas, atheists are better than Christians. And this was a huge blow to me. I was just like, what? This can't be true. But it's even Christian surveyors like George Barna have come to this conclusion. It's very disconcerting to them. And then I thought, well, prayer. We pray all the time. There's got to be great studies that show prayer is true. And you always hear this or you always kind of see these weird studies, but when you really research it, there's no studies that say prayer is true. In fact, if you're in the hospital and have a heart condition, the worst thing you can do is have a bunch of people praying for you because you feel this pressure on you and it makes you have a greater chance to die. And I did this with the Bible. I did everything in every place I turned to find out if my faith were true. It was the opposite. And it was very hard on me. But I couldn't yet admit I had made a mistake about the truth of Christianity. I was hoping for some sort of miracle that would restore my faith. Being an atheist in America, even within my own family, was appalling to me. About 98% of Americans say they believe in God. I wasn't anxious to be part of a 2% minority, especially knowing the passions of the majority. Besides, what if I were wrong? It wasn't the most positive incentive, but the specter of hell did keep me clinging to religion. Facing eternity in Hades was a big price to pay if I were wrong. And if I admitted to my disbelief, what would I tell my kids? It was one thing to send myself to hell. It'd be unimaginable to guide my children along that path. Christians often talk about Pascal's wager, which argues that it's a good bet to believe in Christ. If you're right, you'll spend eternity in heaven. If you're wrong, you'll just be dead like everyone else. But it seems to me to indulge in Pascal's wager, you actually have to believe in Christ. The Lord would know if you were faking, and I could no longer fake it. It was time to be honest about where I was in my faith. As principles go, Occam's razor seemed like a better bet. It basically said that all things being equal, the simplest solution is most likely the correct one. It's becoming harder and harder for me to fit my idea of a loving, personal God into the reality of the world in which I lived. The simplest explanation kept boomeranging back to me. There is no God. So if you're right on the fence about... Thanks. So if you're right on the fence about whether God exists or not, the last place you want to go is St. Michael Island, Alaska, which is exactly where I went. And what happened in Alaska was the good Jesuits were a bunch of assholes. But the good Jesuits, they went to be missionaries in Alaska. And talk about opportunity. In the early 20th century, there's a huge flu epidemic that wiped out about 60% of the Eskimo population, including whole villages. And so the Jesuits were there, and they said, well, look, your gods didn't take care of you. Our gods will. And so just almost overnight, all the Eskimo villages became Catholic, 100%. Great work. And so over the years, if the Jesuits, and it was a great fundraising tool for the Jesuits because they got these little kids in, little Eskimo kids, very cute in the snow, and it said, you know, the world's toughest missionary field, send your money, help the Jesuits, you know, help these poor kids. What the Jesuits would do is when they had a terrible, terrible child molester from anywhere in the world, they'd send them to these Eskimo villages. And these Eskimo villages, the one I went to, there's no roads in and out. You have to take an airplane in or a boat during a couple months in the summer. And there's nothing there. It's like Tijuana with snow. And not even that. There's no law. There's no mental health facilities. There's nothing. There's no running water to this day. And so these missionaries would come in, and they'd be the only game in town. And so in St. Michael Island, this one guy, Joseph Lindowski, he raped every single kid in the village for 8 years. So imagine this happens. He leaves, and imagine these kids grow up, and now they're elders of this village. And the dysfunction, they're already dysfunctional enough as it is, but the dysfunction of this village. And so these people were they didn't talk about, they're very reticent people, they never talked about it, they're very simple people, and they don't have checking accounts, things like that. And so they didn't understand really what was going on. But when the Catholic scandal, they got word of the Catholic scandal, one guy said, you know what, we're people too, and we should stand up and be counted. And so they got a lawyer, and the Catholic Church, the average settlement, at least in L.A. and Orange County, California, was about $1 million, $1.2 million per victim. Catholic Church offered the Eskimo, now adults, $5,000 apiece. Yeah, that's their worth. And then when they wanted more, they filed for bankruptcy because they don't have any money. But there was this one guy named Packy, and Packy was the only Eskimo that retained his faith. And I'll just read a little bit about Packy. On my return home from my winter trip to Alaska, I stopped at Nome's Anvil Mountain Correction Center, where Packy was serving 3 months for assault. Sitting in a tiny visitor's room, I studied Packy's round face. In St. Michael, the Yupiks lived in many ways just as their ancestors did 10,000 years ago. They harpooned whales, tracked herds of caribou migrating across the tundra, and hunted walruses sleeping on icebergs in the Bering Sea. In the midsummer, they gathered wild berries, a key ingredient in Eskimo ice cream, a frozen and oddly tasty concoction of sugar berries, fish, and lard. I ate that before they told me what was in it. Smells of the outdoor life hung heavy in the air in the village, the salt air, strips of salmon drying on the racks, seaweed washed up on the beach. Now, but for Packy, he can only smell the disinfectants used to scrub the jail's concrete floors. Alcohol and a violent temper had put him here often in his 46 years. Wearing navy blue prison clothes, the short, powerfully built man folded his callous hands on the table between us. A homemade rosary hung from his neck, the blue beads held together by string from one of his village's fishing nets. I pointed the rosary. Why do you still believe? It's not God's work that happened to me, he said softly, running his fingers along the rosary beads. They were breaking God's commandments, even the people who didn't help. They weren't loving their neighbors as themselves. I didn't tell Packy about my own doubts of faith. Listening to him filled me with a sense of shame. My faith had collapsed, but he'd been through so much more. I asked him to tell me more. He told me he regularly got on his hands, down on his knees to pray in his jail cell, an act that brought ridicule from the other inmates. A lot of people made fun of me, asking if the Virgin Mary is going to rescue me, Packy said. Well, I've gotten more help from the Virgin Mary through intercession than from anybody else. I won't stop. My children need my prayers. In the late spring, I met Packy again, this time at his home in St. Michael. He told me he'd recently followed the fresh tracks that a grizzly bear had made in the gray sand of a deserted beach. He said he could never commit suicide because it was against his beliefs, but he'd hoped the grizzly would eat him and end his misery. But then, approaching some bushes where he's sure the bear was hiding, Packy had a change of heart. As he ran down the beach, he prayed to Jesus to rescue him. Packy's heart aches for the church in St. Michael. Until recently, he couldn't bring himself to set foot in it. Instead, on Sundays, he'd walk through his dilapidated village, reciting prayers and parts of the Catholic liturgy he had learned from his molester. He included a prayer for his abuser, who died in 1995. The Alaska native asked God to accept his molester into heaven. I pray for him and for his soul, Packy says. I just want him to heal. So with Packy, I thought, thank God I'm not him, because he is. It was the first time I loved not believing in God, because I don't know how I could fit that square peg into that round hole. And when I went to church in the villages, there was one family left going to Catholic church, and I felt a great sense of exhilaration that all the people had turned away from the church. And I started to see the miracles of my Christian life had rational explanations. My born-again experience at the mountain retreat had been about fatigue, spiritual longing, and emotional vulnerability, not about being touched by Jesus. I began to attribute my personal and professional turnaround to maturity, not guidance from God. Landing the religion writing job at the Times was a product of years of hard work and persistence, not divine intervention. I changed in another way. I now saw that belief in God, no matter how grounded in logic and faith, logic and reason requires a leap of faith. Either you have that gift of faith or you don't. It's not a choice. I used to think that you simply made a decision to believe in Jesus or not, collect the facts, and then decide for yourself. But it's not that simple. Faith is something that is triggered deep within your soul, influenced by upbringing, family, friends, experiences, and desires. It's not like registering to vote, checking a box to signal that you're a Democrat, Republican, or independent. Christians often talk to those who have fallen away from the faith as if they'd made the choice to turn away from God. But as deeply as I miss my faith, as hard as I try to keep it, my head could not command my gut. I know now that it was wishful thinking, not truth. I just didn't believe in God anymore, despite my best attempts to hold on to my beliefs. Faith can't be willed into existence. There's no faking it if you're honest about the state of your soul. So I decided I was an atheist, but I didn't want to be an atheist, and I stayed in the closet for a long time. And finally I was a religion writer for the Times, and I saw this play by Julia Sweeney called Letting Go of God. Yeah. And I had no idea what it was about. I mean, I could kind of get a sense from the title, but I thought, well, I'll go see it, and maybe I'll do a story on it. And so I went there, and it was right when she's first doing it. It was in this little tiny theater in Hollywood. And I sat there, and from the moment she started, it was like she was talking right to me. It was my story. And I had goosebumps down, you know, my back. I sat on the edge of my chair, and I just, and here's this intelligent, funny, thoughtful woman who didn't look like kind of my typical, you know, vision of an atheist. And I thought, wow, maybe I could be an atheist. So this is a little bit from her. She said that Sweeney said she finally had to accept what was true over what I wish were true. This was, for me, the most profound moment in the play. I had been wishing Christianity were true, as if I wished hard enough I can turn fantasy into reality. I talk about one of my big problems was death. You know, I just didn't want to die and not have anything. But she just dealt with it so straightforwardly, and with such with no angst about it. It was like, okay, you're dead. It's like before you're born. You know, things are going to be fine. So it was really a huge moment for me. Driving home from the play, adrenaline raced through my body. It felt as though I'd made a discovery that made sense of my life and gave my mind some rest. For me, the play was the key I had been missing in my new worldview. I could now open the door to a new life, one without God. It didn't seem too scary. It felt more like something new and exciting, like exploring a new home. In college, I'd earned money working as a lifeguard on the sands at Huntington Beach, California. It was a perfect summer job, guarding the waters of one of the world's best and most dangerous beaches. I made about 1,500 rescues during my 4 summers there. Most of the swimmers I had helped were caught in rip currents, rivers that form in the surf and pull people out to sea. Rips themselves are harmless. They don't yank people under, they aren't very wide, and they dissipate outside the surf line. But inexperienced swimmers don't know this. All they sense is that they're being pulled quickly out to sea. Panicking, they claw at the water, fighting in vain to get back to the beach. They tire, choke on water, and go down. No swimmer can make headway against a strong rip current. But someone with ocean experience can get out of a rip easily, simply by swimming to its side, or she can just relax and let it carry her beyond the surf, where it will quickly peter out. At first, experiencing doubts about my faith, I acted like one of those frightened beachgoers who swam madly against the current, trying to get back to what I thought was the safety of Christianity. But the current of truth had me and wasn't going to let me go. When I stopped fighting it, I felt relief, even serenity. I decided to ride it out past the surf line to see where it would take me. So this happened. I kind of came to peace with it, and I waited a full year to tell anybody. So I started to tell people. They were quite surprised because I thought I was like the ultimate evangelical Christian. And someone encouraged me to write a column about it for the Times. So I wrote the editor and said, "Would you like a column about how I lost my faith working on the religion beat?" And he said, "Wow, you're gonna have to really pour your guts out and just like expose yourself, and that would be awesome. Do it." So I did it, and it was very scary. There's a time in journalists and newspaper life where you turn in the story, and it's gone through the editing process, but it hasn't been published yet. And so it's sort of like you're like on the Niagara River, and you can't get to, you're going to go over the falls. You know you're going to go over the falls, but you can't get out of it. And so late at night, I'm sitting there thinking, why the hell did I do this? Because, you know, as a religion writer, the nastiest letters you get are from people who are religious, by far. And not politics, not anything, it's religious people. So I thought I was just going to be vilified. I did it to myself. I'm so stupid. I'm just sitting there just completely sleepless. And so I decide to check the internet to see if it was posted on the internet. For some reason, once it's on the page, it's like you can't do anything about it. You're already over the fall, so there's some peace there. So check the internet. There it was. And the worst thing about the story was this hideous picture of me. It was just terrible. But I read the story. Usually when you read is authors, when you read your work, you just hate it. But actually, it wasn't that bad, I thought. And I go, okay, now I can go to sleep. But I had all this adrenaline going, and so I said, I'll just check my work emails. And so this story was posted like 10 minutes before, and I checked my work emails, and I had 4 screens full of like 20 emails apiece about the story. I'm like, oh, shit. But then I look at the subject line. It's like, thank you, congratulations, we're with you. And I ended up getting, it was by far the most in LA Times history. I got over 3,000 emails. And I would say 80% of them were from Christians. And these are people who had huge doubts and no one to talk to about them. And by the way, the worst emails I got were from atheists, a-holes, who would say, how could you waste your whole adult life on a fantasy? How come you learned at 45 what I learned at 7? Yeah. So I got emails from like someone, for example, deep inside the Vatican, who says, you know, there's many people in the Vatican that don't believe any of this stuff, and not surprisingly. Anyway, it was amazing because I would say 99% of the emails were positive, and that never happens from a religious article. And I think there's so many people, and I think this is why you see this in the statistics and whatnot. There's so many people that are culturally religious, but they don't believe a word of it. And when someone comes out honestly, not attacking them as being stupid or anything else like that, but just telling them, you know, what their story is, that resonates with them. And it was a big surprise to me. My story, I think, has a really happy ending, which I'll read to you. With the Bible, among the things the Bible promises, peace and serenity, I found in larger measures as a non-believer. My morals and values haven't changed. I used to see my innate beliefs about right and wrong as something God-given. Now I see them as a product of tens of thousands of years of evolution, encoded in my DNA to best ensure the survival of my family and myself. A sociopath, not an atheist, has no conscience and no ability to tell right from wrong. As a believer, I try to live up to the standards for living outlined in the Bible, that is, the generous and loving parts of Scripture. Nothing has changed since my loss of faith. I still try to follow the same ideals, morals, and values that I'd argue are inherent to each human being. I still find myself stumbling, but now I don't blame Satan. Usually when I do wrong, it's due to selfishness and poor judgment, overcoming common sense, self-restraint, and experience. Truth be told, my actions aren't much different than when I was a Christian. Many of my basic life struggles are the same. I still worry too much, hold grudges too long, lie, usually in small ways, too easily, drink more than I should, I'm too impatient with the kids, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What's gone is the placebo of faith that was supposed to transform me into a better person, to protect me, to guide me, and to eventually to usher me into heaven. The placebo had stopped working long ago, and when I admitted that I had been taking the sugar pill of faith, relief swept over me. My increasing doubts about Christianity hadn't been a sign of weakness or lack of faith or a skirmish with the devil. I'd only been slowly, even unconsciously, headed for the truth. So what has taken the place of God in my life? a tremendous sense of gratitude. I sense how fortunate I am to be alive in this thin sliver of time in the history of the universe. This gives me a renewed sense of urgency to live this short life well. I don't have eternity to fall back on, so my focus on the present has sharpened. I find myself being more grateful for each day and more quickly making corrections in my life to avoid wasted time. I've tightened my circle of friends, wanting to maximize time with the people I love and enjoy the most. I become more true to myself because I'm not as worried about what others think of me. This may be due in part to maturity, but it also has to do with knowing what's of real importance in my one and only life. The sound of a ticking clock counting down the minutes of my life is now nearly impossible to get out of my head. This isn't a bad thing. It's the background beat to a well-lived life. Thanks.